November jobs, not that far from the plus side.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the Morning Open, a look at the economy as trading gets underway for the day. Investors are focused like a laser on that employment report that shows the U.S. lost 11,000 jobs. But if you think they're sad about that, you haven't been paying attention the past year and a half. So let's ask, where's Wall Street? Oh, investors not sad at all. The S&P up about 1.5%. The NASDAQ the same, about 1.8%, as a matter of fact. The Dow ahead now by 142 points at 10,508. European markets, well, they're electrified too by that report. Markets have swung into positive territory about 1% or more. Asian markets closed mixed today. Investors obviously happy about this latest Labor Department report, a drop in unemployment to 10%, 11,000 non-farm jobs cut in November. That's a far cry from what economists were expecting. They were looking at 125 or 130,000 or more jobs lost. Conrad De Quadros is an economist at RDW. He's with us live from New York this morning. Good morning, Conrad.
Good morning.
So why were economists proven so wrong in their expectations?
Well, we had less job loss in some of the areas where we had been seeing significant job declines, and then there was a surprising positive in the temporary help area where we saw significant job gain. So it was a combination of some areas showing less weakness and then a couple of areas actually some positive prints.
Is this an anomaly, do you think? I mean, that we can easily be disappointed next month with something else?
Well, one thing to remember about this report is the month-to-month readings are extremely volatile. So there's the chance of that. But given that there wasn't any statistical quirks within the report and it seems like these signs of moderate improvement were pretty broad-based, I think we're on a path to a less weak employment situation.
Does it take the pressure or some of the pressure off of the government to get involved? I mean, we're talking about the job summit that we had yesterday. I mean, what does the government do now?
Well, you know, I think we need to be clear that although this is not as bad as expectations, we still have an unemployment rate up at 10%, which is extremely high. So the labor market might not be getting significantly worse, but it's still not in a very good state. So, you know, there is a significant degree of improvement that we need to see before we can be comfortable.
I want to talk a little bit about some ideas floating around to pay for some job programs. One that's gained a little momentum is this idea of taxing Wall Street. And we're going to bring in Marketplace's Amy Scott, who's with us live from New York as well, to talk about it. Good morning, Amy.
Hi there.
So how would this work?
Well, yesterday, a group of lawmakers again pitched this idea of taxing financial transactions. Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon and Iowa Senator Tom Harkin, among others, are pushing for a small tax on all futures contracts, derivatives, and stock trades. They say it would raise about $150 billion a year to pay for jobs programs and reduce the budget deficit.
But, Amy, this idea has been raised before. I mean, is there any chance that this is going to pass?
Yeah, well, the Obama administration has been pretty cool to the idea. I spoke to tax analyst Ann Mathias with Concept Capital, a trading and research firm. She says it would raise a lot of money quickly, but says it wouldn't just penalize Wall Street.
When you really get down to brass tacks on it, I think that it is negative for returns that people who hold mutual funds or people who are in pension funds will receive. And when that becomes more obvious to the parties involved, I think that momentum will slow and stop.
And to try to minimize the effect on the average person, the sponsors of the measure say the tax would be refunded for mutual funds and savings accounts for things like retirement and health care.
Hey, Conrad Quadros, I'm extrapolating some of the numbers from this jobs report this morning, and manufacturing and construction are still a couple of the sectors that are losing workers. I mean, what leads us out of that? I mean, how do we get these folks back to work?
Well, manufacturing in some of the survey information, like the ISM survey, has started to look a little bit better. So I think manufacturing is probably more on the road to recovery than some of the other sectors of the economy. Construction, the problem in construction is split between housing and non-residential or business construction. The business construction area, I think, has a long cycle, and we're going to still see some weakness in that for many months. On the residential side, as the housing market starts to bottom out, I think we'll start to see a bit of an improvement there. But more of an improvement, I think, can be expected manufacturing and construction.
Conrad De Quadros from RDQ Economics, thanks.
My pleasure.
All right, Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott, thanks to you as well.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report for Friday, December 4th, 2009, at marketplace.org. A skirmish about the scientific evidence for global warming has blown up just before next week's climate change summit in Copenhagen. And the chairman of the United Nations panel on climate change is calling for a full inquiry. Marketplace European correspondent Stephen Beard is with us from London with the latest. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Steve.
So what's the fuss all about?
It's a row about claims that British scientists have manipulated data to boost the argument that climate change is man-made. Climate change skeptics hacked into computer records at a key climate research unit at the University of East Anglia, and they found and posted on the internet hundreds of emails, some of which could suggest that inconvenient data was being massaged and suppressed in order to make the case that climate change is real and that we are causing it through carbon emissions.
Now, what's been the university's reaction?
The university is taking this very seriously. The head of the climate research unit has stood down from his post, and the university has set up an independent inquiry to look into this. The ripples of this, though, have spread much wider than the UK. The BBC is quoting a senior Saudi official saying this will have a huge impact on the Copenhagen conference. Every country under pressure, he says, to curb its emissions could now seize on these emails and say, why should we damage our economy when there is still, apparently, serious doubt about climate change?
But, Stephen, this is one set of data at one university. I mean, certainly there's other evidence that climate change is occurring. Is anyone saying that these emails severely undermine the case that climate change is man-made?
No. In fact, most climate scientists say there is plenty of other evidence that climate change is man-made. Two other major sets of data, including one by NASA. Nevertheless, this does seem certain to surface at next week's conference in Copenhagen, where, incidentally, Sam Eaton and myself will be reporting for Marketplace.
And we'll look forward to that. Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
In just a few days, world leaders will meet in Copenhagen to discuss climate change, and projecting what the climate will be like several decades from now is no easy task. So British scientists are looking to the past for clues. Christopher Worth has more.
At the UK's National Archives in London, Dennis Wheeler slowly flips through the yellowed pages of a logbook kept by one of Britain's most famous seafarers, the 18th century explorer, Captain James Cook.
On a voyage round the world, performed in the years 1768, 69, 1771. Okay. God, I hope we turned the gas off before we went.
But Wheeler is no historian. He's a climatologist at the University of Sunderland who's leading a project to digitize about 250 years' worth of British Navy logbooks. Wheeler says sea captains like Cook kept detailed records of weather conditions, things like wind direction and air temperature. The logs are a wealth of information about what the climate was like before the Industrial Revolution. Wheeler says he gets one question from people all the time.
Why on earth look at the data of the past? Because what we need to know about is what it's going to be like in 20, 50, or 100 years' time.
His answer has to do with computer models that climatologists use to predict future climate change. Those models can also be used to simulate what happened in the past as a way to test if their projections are reliable. So now scientists will be able to compare their simulations of the 18th and 19th centuries to the actual weather data in the logbooks. Rob Allen heads one of the largest historical databases on climate at the UK's National Weather Service.
It's one check to say, can your models reproduce what we are seeing as appears to actually happen in the climate system? If you can do that, you can feel more confident about using those models to project into the future.
Allen says historical information about storms and floods can be added to the mix, allowing climatologists to better predict similar conditions going forward. And that's valuable to everyone from farmers to insurance companies.
So it's only by, rather bizarrely, only by looking back that we can actually look forward.
Wheeler says there are 120,000 logbooks that date back before 1850, including books from the HMS Beagle, the ship that ferried Charles Darwin to the Galapagos. And once they're digitized, climatologists from all over the world can get their hands on them. In London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Embryonic stem cells can grow into every type of body tissue, and that makes them very valuable for scientific research. But using them is a contentious issue because it requires destroying human embryos. Former President Bush restricted federal funding during his two terms, but President Obama rescinded that. And the National Institutes of Health has already approved 13 stem cell lines for research. Today, an advisory panel looks at approving 20 more. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports the moves are likely to trigger a flood of new investment in medical research.
NIH approval gives stem cell scientists immediate access to $200 million worth of federal research money. Children's Hospital in Boston created some of the stem cell lines the NIH approved earlier this week, and Director George Daley says Bush administration restrictions hindered research.
The NIH funds the lion's share of basic biomedical science in this country, and for the last 8 years, we haven't been able to exploit it for applications in human stem cells. Now we can.
Drug companies and medical device makers are now more likely to invest in their own research, says B.D. Kolin at the Harvard Stem Cell Institute.
I think they are now beginning to see the potential. Because this is more normalized, they will be more eager to get in.
And the results will be new drugs for treatment of diseases from diabetes to Parkinson's. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Some pretty dismal consumer spending numbers came out this week. Turns out Black Friday was actually a dark day for retailers. We're still not spending like we used to. Retailers make nearly half of their money this time of year. So what will another bad holiday mean? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports.
It's beginning to look a lot like another bad holiday season for retailers. Last year, they were caught with too much inventory and had to slash prices. Sluggish sales this year are more bad news, says Conference Board economist Ken Goldstein.
This four-week period between Thanksgiving and Christmas, this is it. I mean, this is the Super Bowl for retailing.
And some retailers are going to fumble. Holiday sales are expected to be 1 to 2% below what they were in 2008. And Goldstein says things are going to get pretty Darwinian in the retail sector.
There's undoubtedly going to be a few that just simply can't make it or wind up combining with another chain because they can't continue to go along.
These leaner times are likely to stick around, says Lynn Colley, professor of marketing at the University of Oregon.
I think that a lot of people are saving more money. Americans probably are permanently going to be a little bit more cautious.
Colley says consumers will start spending again when companies start hiring again. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
General Motors wants to decide what it'll do with Saab by the end of the year after a deal to sell the brand to another Swedish automaker fell through, which leaves Saab and its dealers a couple of nail-biting weeks. How do you sell cars when you don't know what the future holds? We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out.
There are 10 2009 Saabs on the lot at Kelly Cadillac Saab in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Jeff Kelly is the general manager there. He says he still has customers.
We've talked to a couple people in the past week about buying Saabs, and you can't give anybody an honest answer about what the future of Saab's going to be.
He says he can imagine a diehard Saab driver might consider buying. He started a website called Save Our Saabs to convince GM not to kill off the brand. Drivers have written in declaring their passion for Saabs, insisting they're the most reliable cars around.
But, I mean, with all the uncertainty about the future, I mean, it's a difficult decision for somebody to make to spend, you know, $25,000, $30,000, $35,000 to buy a vehicle when the manufacturer may not exist in a couple of weeks.
To help convince the wary, Kelly's dropped the price on one of the cars from $33,000 to $25,000. But he's not sure the discount's big enough to make up for not knowing. Because it's not just the car company that would go away. He says some servicers are already refusing to do warranty work because they're afraid of not getting paid. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
This morning, we tackle unemployment among the world's young people. That's the topic of this morning's Marketplace Globalist Quiz with the editor of Globalist.com, Stefan Richter. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Ready for today's Globalist Quiz?
I am. Let's do it.
So here's the question. Which of these countries faces the highest unemployment rate among its population that is below 25 years of age? Is it Germany? Is it Japan? Is it the United States or Spain, where young people experience the highest level of unemployment right now?
I would say it's got to be between the United States and Spain. I'm going to guess the United States.
Well, young Americans have a hard time right now, but Your original guess was a bingo. You would have been right with Spain.
Wow.
Eurostat, which is the agency in Europe that looks at these numbers, has found that young Spaniards currently experience a 41.7% unemployment rate.
41%.
Yeah. A year ago, well, it was 26%. So that's by far the highest unemployment rate in the developed world.
All right, Stefan, what are the numbers for the United States?
Well, if you look at the different ethnicities, young African Americans have an unemployment rate of 31.2%, Hispanics 21%, and young Asians and young whites are at an even level at around 16%. So quite high, but African Americans really face the steepest challenge right now.
Here in the United States. All right, Stefan Richter, we appreciate you giving us that international perspective this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Stefan Richter is publisher and editor-in-chief of TheGlobalist.com, the daily online magazine on the global economy, politics, and culture. And finally, who knows how many Pashmina shawls a trend does make? In Britain, the department store Debenhams says parents of the stars of the nativity scene are going all out this year. It's being called manger chic, where mom and dad are doling out hundreds on Arctic fur throws or velour gowns for angels. A spokesman tells Reuters it's the intense competition and even a drop in home handcrafting. It's like Bloomingdale's opened in Bethlehem. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. This is Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.